This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, we write the political obituary of one of the most powerful men in Washington. Republican Tom DeLay of Texas announced today that he plans to leave the House of Representatives later this spring and will not run for re-election next fall. Last fall, DeLay was forced to step down as majority leader in the House of Representatives following an indictment for election violations in Texas. In Washington last week, a second former DeLay staff member pleaded guilty and agreed to cooperate with federal prosecutors in a wide-ranging corruption probe. Earlier today, Tom DeLay told his constituents in Sugar Land, Texas, that he's done nothing wrong but decided to quit because his campaign for a 12th term in Congress would become a nasty, personal, and very expensive race, and one he just might lose. "This had become a referendum on me," he told Time magazine, "so it's better for me to step aside and let it be a referendum on ideas, Republican values, and what's important for this district." DeLay says he plans to continue to work for conservative causes and a Republican majority. Later on in the program, David Savage of the Los Angeles Times on the Supreme Court's decision not to hear the case of Jose Padilla, who challenged the government's right to hold him indefinitely without charge or trial, and your letters. But first, the fall of Tom DeLay. If you have questions about his decision to quit, the deepening scandal surrounding him, or what it means for both political parties, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. We begin with Mike Allen, a reporter for Time magazine, who broke this story last night. Mike, very good of you to join us today.
Howdy, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
You spoke with Tom DeLay for 90 minutes last night at his kitchen table. He took you on a tour of his house. Tom DeLay has been a fighter throughout his political career. How did he explain that? Why he's quitting now?
And I think that that's a very astute question. And his wife, Christine DeLay, volunteered. I was ready to fight, she said, when I asked her if she was satisfied with the decision. He several times used the word realist. He said he's a realist. He can look at a political situation. He can read a poll. And his campaign very recently, a week to 10 days ago, got a poll that made the outlook look very bleak. Now, he told me that he had a slightly better than 50-50 chance of winning. But a different way of saying that is his odds were almost even of losing. And the poll also showed him that that split was almost entirely because of him. This is a heavily Republican suburb of Houston. The president polled 65% in this district in the election. At the same time, Mr. DeLay polled 55%. It was an early sign of weakness that very few people picked up on, and that situation has just gotten worse. And as Mr. DeLay said, almost any other Republican would easily win this seat. And so there's a portion of it he didn't want to be the person who cost the Republicans the majority if it came down to a seat or two. He said he didn't want to put his district, his party, through the mud fest that's going to come. And, Neil, another way of looking at it is this avoids the possibility that he would end this extraordinary career with a loss. He's saying now he can say that he's doing this on his own terms, his own timing. He can say that he feels good about it and confident about it, which he does. Go out and speak. I'm sure he'll be in tremendous demand. And he says he can do more for conservative causes on the outside than the end, simply because he's become such a target.
Did he still sound feisty last night, or was he discouraged?
Yeah. Yes, that's very interesting you should ask that, because I was surprised. If you were expecting a little sadness, a little contrition, you just don't get it. When I asked him if he'd done anything illegal, he said no. I said, have you done anything unethical? He said no. I said, have you done anything immoral? And he started to say no and then stopped himself and said, well, we're all sinners. And he and I did have a pretty extensive conversation about faith. He said that he's prayed about this decision a lot. He said that he'd been baptized as a Christian as a young person and had sort of left Jesus almost immediately. He joked about that. And he said that he reopened his relationship with Christ when he came to the Capitol in 84, I guess it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'd never heard that. It's so interesting to get a little behind-the-scenes pictures of these members when they're among themselves, which we don't usually see. Congressman Frank Wolf, Republican of Northern Virginia, he said, had a ministry where he went door to door to the new members and invited them to a Bible study and showed them a James Dobson film. And Doyle went to that, and he said it changed his life.
He, in a speech here in Washington, D.C. just a couple of weeks ago, almost portrayed himself as a victim of liberal Democrats in a campaign to bring him down. Was that in evidence last night?
Well, Neil, you have a good memory, and I think that that is right. He did, for instance, when I asked him if he had failed to adequately supervise people who worked for him, and Neil, as your listeners know, two of his former staff members have pleaded guilty to committing crimes while they worked in his office, accepting things of value. And he said no. He said, I had only two people out of the hundreds who've worked for me disappointed me, and then here's the blame that you were talking about. He said, any office that had been under the scrutiny that mine had been for 10 years, you would be able to find two people who did something wrong. So another example of the lack of contrition that kind of surprised me a little bit. And, Neil, we all have trouble seeing ourselves as others see us. I certainly do. I think everybody struggles with that. But I asked him about these stories that talk about the $740 a night hotel rooms and the limos and the cigars and the resorts and all that.
Golf junkets, yeah.
I'm sorry, yeah. And I said, you know, was any of this high living a mistake? Like, is this appropriate for a servant of the people? And he said it was not a mistake, that he doesn't choose he correctly pointed out that he does not choose the location where these events are that he goes to speak at, that they typically are not held in, you know, Motel 6s. And I'm a big Motel 6 fan, by the way. And he said that he can go and give a speech in the morning or do something important in the morning and then golf in the afternoon, and the media is going to write about the golf. And he did plead guilty to liking golf. He said it's the only thing that he does for himself. And an interesting, I think accurate point that he makes is that whatever he's accused of, it was not for personal gain. And he said, all you have to do is look at my house, which is relatively, it's nice, but relatively modest. He said, all you have to do is look at my house or my bank account to see that.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. 800-989-8255, if you'd care to join us. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guest is Mike Allen of Time Magazine, and Brian's with us. Brian on the phone from Broken Arrow in Oklahoma.
Hi, Neil. Thank you.
Sure.
My question, Mike, and I'll take my answer off the air here. I'm wondering how big a story is this really for the midterm elections? I mean, if you were a Democrat, you really didn't like delay already. If you were a Republican, you know, you knew he was nasty. You knew he was called the hammer. You were just glad he's on your side. So how does this really play into the midterm elections?
Mike, what do you think?
Well, I think it will be harder for Republicans to it'll be hard for Democrats to sort of tag Republicans as the party of delay. I think one thing that this heads off is every Democrat in a close, every Republican in a close district was going to have to answer the question, do you support Tom DeLay?
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of takes them off the hook for that. On the other hand, I think Democrats will argue that this shows that there was some substance to what they were arguing about DeLay. Certainly it shows the concern about how close the House is. I asked him if he agreed with some of the other Republicans who've talked to us that if the election were held today, Republicans would lose the House. He did not. And, of course, Republicans point out the election's not being held today, and they've not run their campaigns, and that would only be a fair statement if we'd been running campaigns since January.
And we'll point out later, there could be more coming as this investigation in Washington, D.C. widens. Even so, Democrats will already be able to point to Jack Abramoff, Mr. Scanlon, to Duke Cunningham, to Tom DeLay, to support their argument of a culture of corruption.
Right. I asked him if Republicans would have insulated themselves somewhat by doing more on lobby reform last year before this became a big public issue. And again, he said no. He said that the solution is not lobby reform, but the solution is to fight them. And so, again, this is whatever enemies out there, I guess this includes the media and Democrats, I asked him if history wouldn't have something of a mixed picture of him, and he said he doesn't really care what history thinks, that he does what he does in support of his principles and his causes, and he doesn't do it to please his critics or detractors.
Let's see if we get another caller in before we have to go. This is Mike. Mike calling us from Brantford, Connecticut.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Hey, other Mike.
Hi, Mike. My question is, if assuming that the case against Tom DeLay goes forward and assuming again that he's found or convicted of something and that he does do some kind of jail time, when he gets out, is he allowed to actually lobby on Capitol Hill? Because I you know, I hope not, but are they allowed to lobby if they're convicted of a crime? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Mike, a couple of big assumptions there, but in theory anyway.
Yeah, I apologize. I don't know the answer to that.
What did Mr. DeLay say he plans to do? Is it lobbying?
No, and you know, I should have asked him if he would do that, but there's no indication he does plan to do that. His plan is to be mainly a public speaker. He said this decision crystallized in his mind last Wednesday when he spoke to that conference about the war on Christianity, and he got a tremendous response, and he realized that he could talk about causes that are important to him, including foster care for children, and increasing emphasis on faith in public life, and, of course, electing Republicans to office. He said that, unlike Democrats, Republicans are sort of split in their groups. You have your homeschoolers here, your abortion opponents here, et cetera, and that there's no one person to unify them. He'd like to be that person, but I don't know if that's going to be a role that a lot of Republicans are going to be anxious to have him endorse, where he says Democrats are a lot better about being on the same issue, that environmentalists will give you the choice line, et cetera.
Mike Allen, good story, good get.
Neil, this was great fun. Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. Mike Allen, a reporter for Time Magazine, in an exclusive interview he spoke last night with Tom DeLay, who said he plans to leave the House of Representatives, will not run for re-election. More on that after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about today's news that Tom DeLay, the former majority leader in the House of Representatives, the man who once reveled in the nickname The Hammer, has decided to leave Congress. In a videotaped statement to his constituents, he explained why.
My loyalty to the Republican Party, indeed my love for the Republican Party, has played no small part in this decision.
To get a response from one Republican, at least, we turn now to consultant Frank Luntz, who joins us today on the phone from Los Angeles, California. Nice to have you with us today, Frank.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. And by the way, your conversation with Mike Allen, he's one of the best reporters in America, and I'm not surprised that he got the scoop. This is a guy who understands politics very well, and Time Magazine is lucky to have him, and you guys were lucky to have him as well.
Well, thank you for that. But are you surprised by the news that that fighter, Tom DeLay, has decided to quit?
A little bit, because Tom is a fighter, and Tom doesn't quit. Tom doesn't give in. And he was never afraid to stand up and say what he believed, and he was never afraid to go out and try to secure an extra couple votes or an extra edge for the Republican Party. Unfortunately, it ended up being his downfall. And the amazing thing is, in some ways, if Republicans are able to keep the majority this year, it will be because of the very circumstance, what happened in Texas, it caused him all these difficulties in the first place.
Are you talking about the redistricting in the state of Texas, which gained the Republicans, I think, what, five, six extra seats last time around?
Five or six seats, and those seats mattered, and it allowed the Republicans to get legislation through this year that they might not otherwise have gotten through. And that effort has actually led to the problems that he's having right now.
He is indicted in the state of Texas on charges of election law violations in the effort to get that redistricting through. Do you take him at face value that he did this out of loyalty for the Republican Party?
It's more than face value. I know him, and I am sure that the average listener to the show, on a 0 to 10 scale, with 10 being popular and 10 being disliked, I'm sure the average listener would give him a negative 4. And yet I will tell you that this was the hardest working member that I had ever known. This is someone who used to get to work early in the morning and stay until late at night, someone who never took time off, someone who Saturdays, Sundays, holidays, was always focused on doing his job. And whether you like him or dislike him, the work ethic that he put in is actually a lesson for Democrats who would like to take over the House, that one of the reasons why Republicans managed to keep control for 12 years is because of DeLay's work ethic, because he never gave up, he never gave in, and he just kept on fighting and fighting and fighting. You may not like what he fought for, but this was a guy who was effective in bringing people together and getting the votes on the floor. And even those who are his detractors would say that he was the most effective whip when he held that job, the most effective whip in the last 100 years, if not ever.
Was he a man of ideas? I mean, you're talking about his ability as a power broker, somebody who could count votes and manipulate votes. What were his ideas?
It's interesting. I'm going to describe Tom as a man of conviction, someone who saw his role not to be the great ideologue, not to be the great thinker that Newt Gingrich was. It was Tom's job to take those ideas and get them passed into law. It was his role to bring members together. And by the way, Tom had some interesting relationships across the aisle that people don't realize. He had some Democrats that he could count on to get support. So he was the guy that actually got things done.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. Let's hear from Roy. Roy's calling us from Austin, Texas.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Roy.
Hi. I've got a couple of comments to make, and then I'll listen to the response off the air. The first is about Ronnie Earle, who's the prosecutor for County.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched him over the years, and the belief that he's going after DeLay because he's Republican, I think it's just not true. I've watched him going after Democrats, Republicans, big companies, small companies. But the one thing he does consistently is once he's got a hold to you, he does not let go. He is really a bulldog. And the second thing is, I'm from an old Texas family, and we've talked about this quite a bit, about corruption and politics in Texas. I think maybe a little different than some other parts in the state. The politicians there tend to do corruption in a group. You know, they believe they're doing things for Texas in general, and they do not mind and will in a heartbeat bend rules. But it's not corruption for personal gain like you might see in other places. So those are my comments, and I'll listen to what you guys have to say.
Okay, Roy. Thanks very much for the call. Ronnie Earle, the prosecutor who brought charges against Tom DeLay, most people in Texas probably now think his first two names in his name are liberal Democrat.
Right, but let's not forget that Ronnie Earle also brought charges against Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, and those charges were just tossed out for being completely invalid. And that this is a guy who has, there's a right and a wrong way to do things. And this is a guy that even a lot of independent observers, those who are not fans of Tom DeLay, have said that the way that he is, I don't even want to use the word prosecuted. I'm going to use a different word, persecuted Mr. DeLay. It just goes beyond the pale. That said, the caller's questions or comments are very well thought out. And Americans are going to decide over the next couple of years what is the proper role of government in terms of pursuing ideas, of pursuing legislation. How far is too far? What is the appropriate level of intensity to go to actually achieve legislation? Where do you compromise? Where do you cooperate? Where do you draw the line? And I think that we're going to have a lot of this discussion over the coming couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear from Mark, and Mark's calling from Lawrence, Kansas.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Mark. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. I just want to comment in regards to DeLay retiring. I kind of have a hard time believing that he retired simply because he felt, I mean, I think I understand the concept that he, you know, his numbers in the polls were dropping, and I think having another Republican coming in will definitely give the Republicans a little bit of a leg up in terms of this coming election. But with the most recent DeLay associate being convicted and cooperating with officials, and kind of the nice long laundry list of involvement that DeLay has been, done, it kind of seems to me like he kind of sees the writing on the wall in terms of possible, convictions coming his way, and that he didn't want to tarnish the Republican Party in that sense, rather than him just simply saying, you know, my poll numbers are hurting and I'm going to retire because of that.
Yeah, was it the fear of the loss of the seat? That must have been part of it, of course, is what he told Mike Allen, but also, Frank Luntz, the gathering clouds around him.
Right. But I agree.
Yeah,
let's
hear what Frank Luntz has to say. Yes, go ahead, Frank.
Again, it's a very well put question and comment, but you have to understand that if a politician does decide to call it quits, automatically the public assumes that whatever they were being accused of is for real. A much smarter approach, if the politician cared about their own personal reputation, would be to stand and fight, because very often they are exonerated. And I actually think the delay is going to win in court. And so for him to step aside says to Americans, well, maybe there is something wrong, and yet delay himself is putting the Republican Party's objectives and goals above his own personal political career. Look, we have never in our teachings, in school, in education, we have never rewarded. We've never found it enticing or of value. An elected official whose job it is to gather votes, whose job it is to secure majorities, the people who work behind the scenes to get 50% plus one. We've always valued the intellects, the thinkers. The truth is, if you look at successful political efforts, it is not the thinkers that actually produce the results. It's the doers. It's those who often work behind the scenes to get the job done. There have been a lot of great minds in America that have come forward that have never actually achieved the majority or achieved success or changed legislation and the world as we know it.
Mark, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And I know we have to let you go, Frank Luntz, but I did want to ask, in his statement to his constituents today, Tom DeLay said, this is a bad day for one Republican, but it's also a bad day for liberal Democrats. Is he right?
I tend to agree with much of what Tom DeLay says. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure it's a bad day for them. I think that they enjoyed the opportunity to attack him, that they enjoyed the chance to use him in their direct mail letters, in their grassroots efforts to motivate the base, just as Republicans love to use Ted Kennedy as the same foil. I do know this, that Americans are tired of politics as usual. I do know that they're desperately seeking some change from this red state, blue state mentality. I do know that they're looking for politicians that offer common ground rather than those that divide. And I do know that they do have a level of expectations for their elected officials that they will listen, that they will hold themselves accountable, and that they will get something done for the people. And so there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of frustration in the American electorate right now towards everybody in Washington.
Frank Luntz, thank you very much. We know you're busy. We appreciate you taking time out to speak with us today.
And I want to compliment your callers. Very smart. Very appropriate questions, and they're going to be asking these questions between now and Election Day.
Frank Luntz, a Republican Party consultant, joined us by phone today from Los Angeles, California. Well, with us here in Studio 3A is Ron Elving, who's NPR's senior Washington editor. Ron, good to have you with us. And let me ask you the same question I just put to Frank Luntz. Tom DeLay said today that it might be a bad day for one Republican, but also a bad day for liberal Democrats. You think that's going to be the interpretation?
I think it's probably a bad day for one Democrat, and that's Nick Lampson, who is a former Democratic member of Congress who lost his seat in Congress because of Tom DeLay's redistricting of that state a couple of years ago. He is the Democratic nominee in the Texas 22nd District, the Tom DeLay District, and he was expecting to run against Tom DeLay in November, and that meant he was going to be able to raise enormous amounts of money, millions of dollars, from people who wanted to see Tom DeLay defeated. Well, Tom DeLay is gone. And so we're going to get another Republican who will not be Tom DeLay and will not be a national symbol of the Republican Party or somebody who has built up the animosity that Tom DeLay has among Democrats and liberal fundraisers all over the country. And as a result, it's going to be much more difficult for Mr. Lampson to raise that kind of money. And suddenly his race will go from being the number one House race of November 2006 to being really just another race in Texas.
One of 435. The other thing is Tom DeLay won a Republican Party primary for this seat just a couple of weeks ago. How did they get his name off the ballot?
Well, it was just 4 weeks ago, March 7th, they had the primary, and he won with 62% of the vote against several opponents. There are only three ways to get off the ballot. Number one, you can die. Number two, you can move out of the district. Or number three, you can be indicted for a crime. Now, of course, Tom DeLay does not want to be indicted for a crime.
He's
not want to be indicted,
indicted
for a federal crime. Well, but it would have to be a federal crime in this case, in his current rap in Texas as a state. He would have to be indicted for a federal crime, and while that is a possibility, he certainly doesn't want it to be a certainty, and so he doesn't want to wait for that to be the problem for his candidacy. So his other option, really, is to move out of the district, and he is probably not really going to move any of his personal effects. He's just going to declare his residence here in Northern Virginia in Alexandria his official residence, his condominium.
We're speaking with NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we've been talking about the gathering clouds around Tom DeLay. That's surrounding the investigation, not just this election law case, state case in Texas, but the what's known as the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal. How close has this gotten to Tom DeLay?
It got pretty close last week, where a former deputy chief of staff named Tony Rudy pled to one count of conspiracy to corruption in Congress. And in the indictment, there was an unnamed congressman number two. But looking back over Mr. Rudy's employment, it's clear that they're talking there about Tom DeLay. This does not, of course, make him an indicted person. And by the way, a moment ago where I said he could lose his place on the ballot by being indicted, I mean being convicted of
yes.
a crime. He has, as you said, already been indicted for one in Texas, but the real threshold there is to be convicted. In this particular case, I think Tony Rudy has already been convicted by his plea agreement and is cooperating with the federal authorities. There are some other names of former DeLay staffers, including his former chief of staff back in the 90s, Ed Buckham, who is extraordinarily important to Tom DeLay, who's been his spiritual advisor, who lives in a religious community out in Western Maryland, who is involved in a great number of Tom DeLay activities and who ran a group called the Alexander Consulting Group, which still does exist in a legal sense as a lobbying organization and a lot of other things. These people have been part and parcel of Tom DeLay's large operation in Texas and in Washington and really around the country for a long period of time. If somebody like Tony Rudy is pleading guilty, if somebody like Ed Buckham might be indicted, and he has not been indicted yet, if these things are happening, Tom DeLay has a reasonable expectation that he may himself be indicted. And this is a critical factor to why he is, I think, resigning and choosing not to run for re-election. If he runs for re-election, in the same sense that Nick Lampson was going to spend millions, Tom DeLay would have to raise and spend millions of dollars. He has a certain amount of money now. If he doesn't spend it on the campaign, he can use it for his legal defense.
Yeah, we were just going to get a caller in on, I think, just on that point. Adam is with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi, yes. That was kind of the question and comment that I was having was whether or not all the money, it was my understanding that all the money that he had raised for re-election could now be used as his legal defense money, and that could only be done if he went ahead and dropped out of the race right now as opposed to being defeated or some other circumstance. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Adam, thanks very much for the call. Ron, I think you just said that is the case. But Tom DeLay didn't just raise money for his races. He raised an awful lot of money for a lot of Republican races.
Going all the way back to the early 1990s, Tom DeLay was out and about in the country raising money, not just for people who were already in Congress, but for people who were going to run for Congress, who might run for Congress, who didn't have much of a good chance. And he helped people really get their start. So when they all did get elected in 1994, the Republicans took over 52 seats net in one election in the Great Revolution. At that time, a great number of them, well, they looked to Newt Gingrich as their titular leader, and he was the first speaker after the revolution. A lot of them felt they owed just as much of a debt to Tom DeLay. He'd been the guy out there helping them get elected and helping them raise money. And he's stayed with that formula all through his career. He's raised money for other people, very generous with his time, very generous with his substantial fundraising ability.
Have a few seconds before we have to go to a break, Ron, but earlier Frank Luntz was saying this was a guy who preferred to remain behind the scenes. After Newt Gingrich's departure, Tom DeLay, could he, had he wished to, become Speaker?
I don't think there's any question he could have. He was the most powerful figure in the House after Gingrich. He really was the man behind the impeachment drive in 1998, much more than Gingrich or anyone else. And at that moment, when Gingrich went down right after the election, November 1998, I don't think there's any question he could have been Speaker, but he chose to promote his deputy over him, Dennis Hastert, and he's been Speaker ever since.
We'll have more on this conversation after a short break. Also, yesterday's Supreme Court decision deciding not to hear the case of Jose Padilla. David Savage of the Los Angeles Times will join us to talk about that and your letters. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving about Tom DeLay and his decision announced to his constituency earlier today to leave Congress later this spring, in all probability. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Rick. Rick's with us from Shawnee in Kansas.
Yes, my comment was that I think we should be looking closer at this man's record and the policies that he pushed over the years. I mean, I remember back when he went to the House floor of the House after the Columbine disaster and blamed the teaching of evolution for that and tried to tie the two together. I just think he was, from where I sit, he was demagogic. The policies, he was a power broker for the powerful. And we're talking earlier about how hard he worked and how good he was for the Republicans and how good he was at rounding up votes, and that's never a pretty process. But to me, he took it to new lows. And it's one of the reasons why the average Joe is so cynical about Congress and the way it works, because it seems to work for everybody but them. Even CEOs of some major corporations complained about some of the tactics that they used in order to solicit funds, even when those same corporations might eventually benefit from the legislation that went through. It was such a strong-arm tactic that it just seemed to take us into the partisanship and the absolute gridlock that we have right now, where you had to pay to play and you couldn't play with anybody else. You had to be solely aligned with the conservative Republican wing or you were shut out of Washington. And I'll take the comments.
Rick, thanks very much for the call. Ron Elving, hard to argue with the idea that Tom DeLay made Congress more partisan than it used to be.
He was a strong tactician in service of strong ideas. Tom DeLay was never a middle-of-the-road guy. All the way back to his days in business, before he got into the Texas State Legislature. In the Texas State Legislature, he was known as an extraordinarily hard-charging conservative. And when he came to Washington, he brought those values. In the early time after George W. Bush was declared the winner of the 2000 presidential election, there were people who were saying, you know, Al Gore won the majority of the votes, or a plurality of votes, in the popular vote. You know, you guys in Congress, even though you Republicans may be in control of the House and Senate, you really kind of ought to go slow, because this was a divided country. It was red-blue. We were 50-50. You remember all that talk. Tom DeLay said immediately, I'm having none of that. He says, I have not been in politics all my adult life. I have not been here in Congress since 1984. So that when I finally got my hands on the levers of the presidency, the House and the Senate all at the same time, I was going to go slow. That was not ever Tom DeLay's idea. And when you talk about ideology, whether it's economics, tax policy, budget policy, free enterprise, whether you're talking about social issues, I think of all the things, Tom DeLay was consistent across the board. He was always at the most conservative, a reach of the party's mix on all of those issues. And I think the one thing people are going to remember about this last term he was in Congress, more than anything else, will be the way he led the fight on Terri Schiavo to get Congress involved, to strip the courts of their authority, and to keep her feeding tube in place. He was defeated on that in the courts, the state courts, the federal courts, and he was defeated on that in terms of public opinion, which was 70%, a huge figure, 70% against the idea of Congress getting involved in that family decision. And as a result, he got perhaps the first of a series of bloody noses that he has suffered over the last year. That was just a year ago that happened.
Is there, since he left as majority leader in the House of Representatives, now his decision to leave Congress, who's taken his place? Is there anybody who can keep the Republicans marching in lockstep the way that Tom DeLay could?
Technically, his place has been taken by John Boehner, who is now the House Majority Leader, and he was elected to that job in January. He and Tom DeLay were not close. There was a person who was closer to Tom DeLay who was up for that job and was defeated by John Boehner. So that particular continuity has been broken. Is there anyone who has the effectiveness at making people vote against their own personal wishes or against their own personal political interests because Tom DeLay wants him to and makes it so uncomfortable for them that they go along with Tom DeLay? No, I don't think there is anyone who can fill that role in the current Congress. I don't see anybody with that combination of power and personality.
Ron Elving, thanks very much for this. Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor. Of course, much more on this story later today on All Things Considered. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court and the case of Jose Padilla.